That's Elephant's Gerald. I'm Rick Kogan, back from my 1 week off. Longest, I think, I've ever been off the radio. It is my unbelievable pleasure to have in here for the next hour. I'm playing Elephant's Gerald. We're talking Elephant's Gerald after 10. Someone I admired since I began in this business, even though he was in the better end of the business, the make-money end of the business, television. Walter Jacobson is in here to talk for an entire hour because, many reasons, but because it was your birthday. It was your birthday on Friday. How did you celebrate your 80th birthday, Walter?
I did what I do every Friday, which is go to East Bank and work out and have lunch with a friend and then head out toward Indiana, where we have a cottage on the lake for the weekend.
You mentioned in Rob Feeder's column, his blog, his thing, that you attribute this longevity, an 80s longevity, to the fact that you work out every day?
Yeah. Well, I try to. Sometimes I miss a day, but it's a 5 to 6 days for sure a week. I mean, it's not heavy workout. But the reason I did that, you know, I went through, like our friend Bill Zemme and others we know, went through cancer.
I know.
And I was one of these guys who was always picking on the tobacco companies for trying to advertise and capture kids, right?
Yeah.
So all the time I was doing that, I was smoking.
You were participating,
right.
Yeah.
So I went in for a general physical examination and was told that I should have a prostate examination, which I had, and the doctor said that you've got a problem. We don't know how bad it is, but there's a little tumor on your prostate. Mm. Don't worry about it. You may have been through this, too, where doctors always say that prostate cancer grows more slowly than any other kind of cancer.
I've heard that.
You'll die of something else before you'll die of prostate cancer.
Right.
But they said to me, you know, why don't you just get rid of it? You can have surgery is one choice. You can do nothing and just wait. Or you could do radiation. Radiation sounds horrible. I keep thinking of...
Well, going under the knife sounds horrible to me, too.
Oh, well, he said,
I mean, all of it sounds horrible to me.
This was just 2 years ago.
Yeah.
He said, at your age, surgery is not the greatest thing.
Huh,
so
interesting.
Do the radiation. Reluctantly, I went in to see the radiation doctor who said, okay, and we'll do this. And he told me what it involved. And he said, but before we can, we have to take a test of you. It looked like one of those machines that you just go in for X-ray.
Yeah, sure, like going through in the airport or something.
Right,
yeah.
And on that, they found a huge tumor on my lung. My internist said, you're lucky to be alive.
Jesus.
And you better get it taken out right away. So I went, this was 2 years ago.
Yeah.
I went in for surgery. The surgeon said, I will not operate on you unless you stop smoking at this minute. I said,
were you in the hospital?
I was in the hospital then.
Yeah.
No, I was not ill. I didn't go to the hospital. I just went to see the surgeon to talk about this 2 inch.
About the surgery, yeah.
Yeah.
And you stopped it. You did stop. I know you did.
Yeah,
you're proud of that, too.
That,
yeah, you're proud of that, too.
But I hate it. I still love Mrs. Cigarette, you know.
Well, you smoked for a long time. Did this give you, you know, Walter, even turning, the whole notion of turning 80 can make, or 75 or 70 in some cases, can make one very reflective and very philosophical about the meaning of it all. Did that back-to-back 1-2 cancer punch make you sense your own mortality?
No, that didn't make me sense it as much as knowing that I was going toward 80 years old.
Yeah.
I have a couple of really old dear friends who are that too, so we've begun talking about that. And the sense of mortality does seep in.
Sure.
And I find not only myself, but a couple of other people I know who are my age thinking how life was. And I say, my life has been great. If it's time for me to go, I'll go. That's okay. I couldn't ask for anything more than what I've done for the past 50 years. So I don't see myself in any kind of a scheme to get older and survive.
Or regretful at all. Yeah.
And I'm perfectly healthy now.
Sure.
Both tests came back totally clear. All I have to do is go back every half a year or so to just make sure nothing has come back.
You can't smoke anymore, Walter. You know that.
I know. I miss
you
that. God.
Well, a lifetime of smoking makes
I've never seen you without a cigarette.
I stopped.
Come on.
I stopped. You helped inspire me to stop. Yeah.
How long ago?
About a month and a half.
Why?
Because I got bronchitis and I thought I was going to die.
No
seriously.
Kidding.
Yeah, no kidding.
Cold turkey.
So we're together. Well, no cold turkey. Patches, gum, ice cream, you name it. Anything that I could find.
And now?
I'm fine. I feel pretty good. I mean, I miss it.
You do miss it.
I miss
it.
Of course. Anybody who does this misses it. Yeah. All right, Walter Jacobson, talking about hospitals, you were born at Michael Reese Hospital.
I was.
80 years ago. You were a South Sider for a while, right?
I lived off and on in the South Side as I was older. But I was born there, but I grew up in Rogers Park.
All right. How does a young man who is not named Daly or something become a bat boy? Legendarily, you're a bat boy for the Cubs. One thing I've never seen that's never been explained to me is, how do you get a job like that,
Good
Walter?
Question.
How did you get that job?
I'll tell you, if you promise me when I go on and on and on, you'll say enough, Walter, and cut me
no!
off.
No! This is the first of many. I'm doing the autobiography of Roger Badish, our newsman, and now I'm doing the autobiography of the audio autobiography of Walter Jacobson.
Okay, I'll try.
Go
the
ahead,
number.
Go on for an hour. If it's boring, I'll stop you.
Okay, great. And don't feel shy about stopping.
I won't.
No, you won't. I'm
I
sure.
won't.
My mother was a Cubs fan. We lived on just off Sheridan Road on the north side. And in 1945, when the Cubs were in the World Series,
yes.
My memory is standing at a dining board in the kitchen, ironing board.
Ironing board.
That's a problem with being 80.
Don't worry
I'll
about
it.
I'll
tell you this.
We all know what you
Standing at the ironing board, listening to the Cubs, and I was, because very close to her, became a Cub fan, but just on the radio, and decided that one day I am going to be a Cub player.
Yes, of course.
But we all thought that, right?
Like all young Jewish kids in the 40s. Yeah,
exactly.
Right.
And I wanted to play second base.
Mm-hmm.
I used to go to the Cub games. I'd get on the subway and go to Addison and get on the elevated.
Yeah.
Get off at Addison and go to Cub games by myself all summer long, climb over the turnstile and talk the usher into letting me in.
Of course.
And when I was 13, Rick, I think I was 13 or 14.
Yeah, that'd be about
right. I wrote a letter to P.J. Wrigley.
P.K. Wrigley. The owner, doesn't matter.
Yeah.
The owner of the Cubs.
Right. I wrote it and sent it to Wrigley Field, telling him that I wanted to be a bat boy. Was there any chance I could? Of course, I didn't get a letter back, but very shortly thereafter, I did get a letter back from his public relations guy, who said, come in and talk to us. Why? I have no idea. My letter must have been, it's too bad I didn't keep it. It must have been just effusive.
Oh, my God.
About how much I
love
the Cubs.
Fortune now, yeah.
Because I loved the Cubs. I used to go to like 20, 30 games
a
year.
Wow.
And he called me in, and I met with the groundskeeper chief, who was in charge of hiring and taking care of the bat boys, and we talked for an hour. My dad had, by then we had moved up to the North Shore.
Yeah.
My dad drove me down to Wrigley Field and waited outside while I went in and talked. And it didn't sound from this guy, Bobby Dorr was his name, it didn't sound from him that I was going to get a job as a bat boy, but he asked me questions that kind of hinted to me that maybe I had a chance at it. And when I left there, went back outside and got in the car, my dad said, what'd he say? I said, he asked me questions like, how tall am I? What's my weight? How will I get out of school to be a bat boy? Why do you want to be a bat boy? Oh, because I just have
my
to be a bat boy.
My mom loves the Cubs.
Right.
My mom loves
right,
the Cubs.
Right. Whatever it took, right?
Yeah, sure.
So nothing happened, Rick. I had this interview. My dad didn't want to make me feel like I was a failure.
Sure.
He said, you'll get it.
You'll get it.
Maybe you won't, but I know he was thinking, I hope I don't, because he'd have to drive me down.
He's going to be the chauffeur. He's going to be the first Uber driver.
Right. So I just waited, and I always listened to the Burt Wilson Cubs news.
Yeah.
Is that right, Burt Wilson
yeah,
Cubs
I think
news?
So, yeah.
Every night at like 6 or 6 o'clock. And I was listening to it one night, maybe 3 months after I had gone down to Wrigley Field, and as I turned it on, he was saying, and the Cubs have announced, and then I heard Upson. Upson will be the Cubs' new bat boy for this season, 1952. And I thought, oh, damn, I mean, it's gone.
Yeah.
Until the phone started to ring. People calling, friends called, relatives called. And
you
said,
didn't hear the Walter
I didn't
Jake.
Even hear the Jake.
You didn't hear the Upson. Walter Jake
Upson.
Part. Right. Oh, my God, what a great, great
story.
My
mother called Wrigley Field that night and
right.
said, my son will not get off my neck. He says that he was he was named bat boy for the Cubs. And is it true? And the guy or woman on the other end of the phone said, you'll have to call back tomorrow. So she called back tomorrow. Make a long story short, yes, it was true. So
that is a fabulous story. Were your parents jumping up and down? Well, your mother must have been thrilled.
Well, I was thrilled because of the Cubs. But
yeah.
I don't think they were thrilled.
To have to drive you down from Glencoe. That's a great story. Ladies and gentlemen, you have heard the definitive tale from the Bat Boy's mouth of how Walter Jacobson became a Bat Boy.
A letter to P.K. Wrigley.
We will
to
now.
All you young kids who want to be Bat Boys.
Yeah, good luck. Yeah, good luck. Right to Tom Ricketts. Right. Good luck. Good luck getting your letter there. We'll be back in a couple minutes, and we will then begin, and I mean just begin, to explore Walter Jacobson's career as a college kid and then as a journalist. We'll be right back. That's Ella Fitzgerald. We'll be talking about her later. Now we're in the midst of examining the life and times of my guest Walter Jacobson, who turned 80 years old on the 28th. Aubrey Mumpower just informs me, our great engineer, that he turned 90 on the 28th. No, he informed me that his birthday shares a birthday with Walter and is probably, I don't know, Aubrey, 50, 45. I don't know how old
you
are.
I believed you there for a second.
Yeah. His hair is whiter than yours, Walter. So I'm so totally confused. Aubrey Mumpower turned 68 the day Walter Jacobson turned 80. Walter, he has finished his year as a Cubs bat boy. He has decided to go from Nutrier High School to Grinnell. When did the journalism bug grab you? Because you eventually wound up at the Columbia University School of Journalism. When did you decide, Walter, that you wanted to be a journalist? And tell me, because I remember these times too, what did journalist mean at the time? I don't think kids said, hey, I want to be a journalist and be on TV. Know what I mean?
Absolutely not, especially at my age. You want to know the age?
Yeah.
When, you ask?
Sure.
5 years old, 6 years
old. Wow, why?
I knew I wanted to be a reporter and never wanted to be anything else. And here's a sad story. It happened because I remember, I knew I was riding my tricycle around Kenmore and Devon Avenue at the Sovereign Hotel.
Sure.
And there was a crowd gathered. And I looked up from my bike, and there was a guy standing on a ledge outside of a window, and he jumped and splattered on
sidewalk.
Me and my bike.
Oh, my God.
And I pedaled home as fast as I could to tell my mother what I had just seen. And she wanted to protect me. She was afraid that I was mistaken. But all I wanted to do, she told me later, was tell the story.
That is
so that's where the reporter's bug
that
began.
That is fascinating.
And it never left, Rick, from one place to another.
You have been also as energetic a reporter as this town has ever seen, more than 50 years. I should tell you all that much of what you'll hear tonight, and Walter will be on again in October, I'll tell you why. That is because his fascinating and clear-eyed and very self-effacing biography, Walter's Perspective, a memoir of 50 years in Chicago TV News, published first in 2012. It's still available in hardcover. It's going to be reissued this October in paperback. So Walter will be on again. So don't think you're going to get all of Walter here. You're just going to get a taste of Walter. It's a remarkable book. I reviewed it and had some unbelievably nice things to say, and I didn't always have nice things to say about you, which we'll talk about too, but that's a remarkable thing. So you went to college with the notion of becoming a journalist. Were you imbued at all, Walter, with the whole, you know, the front page era kind of thing? You had to have seen the movie and you had to know a little about what, scene.
Rick, I don't think I had strong feelings about what journalism may have meant, not only for me, but to the country as a whole. It wasn't a subject that was discussed the way we're hearing it being discussed.
Yeah, and you wouldn't have journalism classes at Nutrier. They might have been a school paper.
Yeah, that's right. And I was a sports editor of the Nutrier News, so it just kept growing, but not in a philosophical or even a business sense of what it was all about. And
basically, since this tricycle thing, you wanted to tell the story,
Right. And I wanted to be a newspaper reporter. I wanted to be a writer. And my heroes in the business were writers for the New York Times, Scotty Reston and
sure.
that crowd. And I had no interest, never thought that I could ever get into television. It didn't mean anything to me. I wound up being on the other side of that formula.
Well, you started, though. You started in the classic newspaper training ground, the City News Bureau,
right.
which was, for those of you no longer exists, but for those of you people who don't know, it was the ultimate training ground. It was not the most pleasant place to work, but you learned how to do it, did you not, Walter?
You learned if your mother told you she loves you, check it out.
Check it out.
That's right. And there was a lot to learn and a lot going on. I mean, the city never sleeps, of course.
Well, and also, you have been, I just want one kind. This is the greatest news, Don. I forget New York. Forget Donald Trump. This is bar none, the greatest news town. Politics is like sports, just on every single level. So I want to get, before we take another break, I want to get you went to UPI, right, after
right.
the City News Bureau. Did you try, after the City News Bureau, to get a job at one of the then four newspapers in town?
Well, yes. You know, my first job in the business was as a leg man for the columnist at the Daily
Chicago
News,
American.
Jack Mabley. Yeah. Well, he started the Daily News, and then he went to
That's
the
right.
And he kind of helped guide me through. I met him because he was covering sports, and he came to a Cub game one day when I was bat boy, and he was asking me questions. And I then insisted that I be able to ask him questions. So then I never stopped. What do you do? What's it like? I think it was that stage, as you just mentioned.
What was your curiosity? He sensed your curiosity, I think, too.
Oh, maybe.
And my
willingness to work hard. He let me do whatever he needed to be done.
That's what leg men, as they
right.
call them, do. They're
that's
sort of
right.
very glorified assistants, but they do learn a great deal. It always befuddles me, and sort of a modest heartbreak that people like Mabley was a giant in this town. When Jack was writing his column, it was as popular. This is when there were four newspapers and they each had hundreds of thousands. The Tribune probably had more than a million circulation. It certainly had more than a million
really?
In those days. Mabley was a giant in this town, was he not?
Oh, my God, was he a giant. And was he my hero?
Yeah.
Was he straight-laced? He was a former
oh,
Marine.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And he was on the more conservative side of most issues, but he had a big heart, and he thought about the little people and the poor people, and people loved him. And, you know, he went on to work as he was retiring at a suburban newspaper.
Yeah. He had, you know, the thing is, I mean, I find that there is no immortality. I think, especially for newspaper writers, and maybe a little more for television journalists, but that's something I want to.
You know,
I don't want people. People should not forget people like Walter Jacobson and Mike Royko and Jack Mabley, who informed people for decades. We got to take a break. This is one of the reasons I love having Walter on, because he has this kind of perspective on what journalism has meant to Chicago, to the world, and how it is changing, perhaps not for the better. So please stay tuned. He's on for another half hour. Then he'll be on in October. Then he'll probably be on in December and February and on and on and on, because Walter's had an amazing life. The book is called Walter's Perspective, a memoir of 50 years in Chicago TV news. Some of the stories he's telling tonight are in there, and a lot of others, too. So we'll take a break, then we'll get some news. Ella Fitzgerald will be talking about her at 10. We are just scratching the surface in the life and times of Walter Jacobson, who it's a good reason to have someone on, because they turned 80, but Walter could be on any time, and he will be on again in October when the paperback edition of his fine, fine 2012 biography, Walter's Perspective, a memoir of 50 years in Chicago TV news, hits the stands. It will make the perfect, perfect Christmas gift for you and all of your news-loving pals. He is now, we have him now, working for the legendary columnist Jack Mabley as a leg man, which is a more than an assistant. A columnist had to fill. Mike Royko had a series of leg men. He used to call them leg creatures because they were men and women. What did you do for Jack? It's a great training ground, too.
To be that young and be in a newsroom with
yeah.
the green hats and the typewriters.
No kidding.
All the time and
the cigar
wire smoke services.
And the guys, bottles in the drawer. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. He had me open his mail. He'd get 20 or 30 letters a day. One of them was from a nudist colony in Indiana, the name of which I can't remember.
Mm-hmm.
And he's inviting him to come and spend a day, hoping that he, of course, would write a column on it.
Of course.
He sent me to take his place. He called him up.
That is the greatest young person assignment I have ever heard of in this business.
I must have been about 19 years old.
Oh.
So he said, go take notes, bring your notes back to me.
Where were you supposed to keep your notes? Where are you?
Oh, you haven't got the... Oh, you know I had to get undressed. I was going to surprise you with that.
Well, it's a nudist colony.
Yeah, but not for a reporter.
Oh, right. Yeah, you can just walk in with your clothes on and look around.
Well, I walked in with my clothes on. Uh-huh. I went to the administrative office, and she welcomed me, and she said Mabley had called and told her that I was coming and to please help me get my story. And she said, you're perfectly welcome to... Be anywhere on the grounds, play mm-hmm. volleyball, go to the swimming pool, go to lunch. The only thing you have to do is take off your clothes. And I was at my first major crunch in the business.
Your first crisis in the business.
I couldn't say no. I mean, I had a great
opportunity. You're a reporter. Of course you couldn't say no. How could you say no?
So I did. And she gave me a little bag to put around my wrist. And in the bag, I could put my notebook and a pen and then go wherever I wanted to go. And then when I get to the lunch hall, when the bell rang, I had to get into a line. This was co-ed nudist colony.
Uh-huh.
I had to get into a long line to wait for food, a tight line to wait for food, which I did, had my food, cleaned up, and had to put my things, the garbage in the container, and then...
When you, Walter, would walk up to one of these, one of your naked interview subjects and say, hi, I'm Walter Jacobson from the Chicago American, can I talk to you? Were they reluctant?
No, they were not at all reluctant, and they all had basically the same story, which is the class that you're in life disappears when you're naked. There's no difference between anybody except the size of things. And so
the size of things. Yes, that's well put. The size of things. Jack wrote that column. You came back with your notes?
Oh, not only did you write it. I came back. I gave him the notes, and the next day he said, I sent my young assistant, Walter Jacobson, to take my place at a nudist colony, and here are his notes. He ran my notes as the whole column. Right.
How interesting.
And he wound it up with the greatest punchline.
He also must have been really proud of you.
I think he was, yeah.
You know, I can see guys in a newsroom going, hey, we sent the kid down to the nudist colony to get naked. He went to wonder what's going to happen. How long did you work for Jack?
Just 2 summers.
Yeah.
And then I wanted to stay, and he said, no, you've got to go back to school. When you're finished with school, we can talk again.
So
I kept in touch.
When you did finish with school, you came back here, obviously, and you wanted to be a newspaper reporter.
Right.
Did you do that at all before going to...
No. Yes. I was a news reporter at Chicago's American.
Right.
I was assigned to a city hall, to the Cook County office building. That was my beat.
Yeah.
And I was there every day. And the daily news reporter was Ryko.
Sure was, man. Sure was.
So guys, that's when we began to fight.
You guys had a very... This is for the next show. You and Mike had a very interesting relationship. I think there was considerable jealousy involved on his part.
On his part, I doubt. On my part, not jealousy.
Oh, no, I know.
I just wanted to beat him.
There was some envy. And there's always, it's always jealousy when someone else is getting a story you didn't get. That's what I consider jealousy. The jealousy of the scoop.
That's right.
The jealousy of the scoop. And you guys were competing, and you did start competing against one another. And then you were doing your perspectives when Mike was doing his column. And boy, for those of you who don't remember Walter's perspective, they were hard-hitting pieces, man. And he had unbelievably good sources, too. That was another thing that people – I literally believe that people in City Hall, if there was two phones, they were either calling you or Mike, don't you think?
I hope you're right. That sounds very good.
No, sure. I think it's absolutely, absolutely true. What lured you away from print
in my life?
What was it that – was it a person? Was it a, hey, TV looks really fascinating? What lured you away? Because you seem
That's
to
easy.
Have been born since the tricycle thing right. to be a print reporter.
That's an easy question for me to answer.
What is it?
I was I was a pretty aggressive reporter at Chicago's American.
Sure.
And one of my workmates, we were never friends, didn't really like each other. He was much older than I.
Yeah.
He was hired by Channel 2 News away from the American to be the news director at Channel 2. He was there for half a year, and he called me up because he remembered my time at the American being kind of like him. His name was John Madigan, mm-hmm. a pushy Irishman from the South Side. I was a pushy young Jew from the North Side, and there was that connection. But he respected, or at least saw me as an aggressive, fighting reporter who might help him in the radio.
Sure.
So he called me up and said, you want to come over here and be a reporter instead of being...
Radio.
For, yeah.
Because John Madigan,
television.
Television. John Madigan became famous for that news radio. 78.
Right.
But he was a smart guy.
Right.
He was a very smart, shrewd guy. So,
and he was a loyalist, a Mayor Richard J. Daley loyalist.
Oh, no question.
You know, the Southside Irish, they were all together. And he...
What was it, though? Was it a challenge for you? Or was it money?
No, it had nothing to do with money. I didn't even know what money was at that time.
Yeah, you're right, yeah.
I think I may have had an idea that there was more money in television, but I wasn't thinking
about
that. I just wanted to know what it was in television that made it so prominent.
Yeah.
Why was television so successful? Why don't I go see if I can take – I said I'd take the job.
Sure.
But I had to go to the – I didn't want to lose my job at the American. So I went to the boss. His name will come to me in a minute.
Yeah,
you'll know who
it
was.
Doesn't matter.
And I said, could I take a six-month leave of absence to try TV? I've wanted to know what it's like. He said, you walk out of this place, and he used
a word
we could use on television.
Yeah.
Don't you ever come back if you want to go into television. You go there and stay there. I couldn't resist chance to see what it was like, so I went.
It's a gauntlet. It's a challenge. It's thrown on the ground to you.
Yeah. And you know what, Rick? As you know, there's recognition in television that you don't get in print and on the radio.
No kidding.
Yeah, and television has a greater impact on the community, a greater impact on City Hall. So there are a lot of good things about it. There wasn't a lot of money when you start as a reporter.
Sure.
Not much more than newspapers.
Well, especially news operations in those days. They didn't see news operations as the money cow that people see news operations now. They saw it. And also at the time, to make that switch, I mean, I think in the 60s that television was looked down upon. There wasn't a great deal of substance to it. You know, Walter, and I think that's probably why they brought Madigan over and hired you over. You know what I mean? Newspaper guys looked down on TV in those days, didn't they not?
Oh, still do, don't they?
No.
John Cass always nails a news reporter.
I know. Some do, some don't.
Yeah. But there's that jealousy because television people do make more money. Not so much anymore, Rick,
because
who are on television now are brought in here from Iowa and Kansas because they're inexpensive.
Right.
They don't know Madison Avenue from Madison Street a lot.
And also the fracturing of television over the last – I mean, there used to be some big, big salaries in this town.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, big salaries. I think it wasn't a two, but maybe it's seven. I think four people made like $1 million a year. Sports guys were making $1 million a year. We're getting way ahead of ourselves.
Oh.
But – what did you first think of when you – were you comfortable on camera?
No. Here's what happened. I was first – maybe John Madigan said you can be a writer. He didn't say you're going on television as a reporter, and I pestered him enough to let me finally go on the street every now and then be a reporter. And I went out very soon after I got there to cover a fire on Michigan Avenue, and there was just some smoke coming out of a window near the bridge. And I did a little report on the 6 o'clock news.
Huh.
And the phones lit up. People who saw me, oh, Walter, your friends, you are now on television. There was more recognition and more ascending power being on television at a fire than there was writing a column in the Daily News, which I found disturbing. But at that point, I realized that there's a lot of impact. And I could make things better for a lot of people, which I'd like to do. So I was going to stay. And then I was mostly a writer on Sunday at noon. I was a producer and writer of a Sunday noon show. I didn't do any. I've never done any anchoring. The anchor man for that noon day called in sick. and they had nobody to do the news. I was there producing and writing in shorts and a T-shirt, and I had to go do the news. So I scrambled around the dressing room looking for a tie and a shirt, and I stood on a box about a foot and a half high so I could get behind the podium and look like I was reading the prompter when it went wrong. They were kidding me over my earphone, saying that I had to take my clothes off because I needed to get a mic that only worked.
Back at the nudist colony. Yeah. This is unbelievable.
Right.
You're back at the nudist colony.
I got through it, but I had the bug.
Well, it also, it's in the same way that I think this is, says something about Walter's fortitude and kind of innate appeal that he convinced the Cubs in a conversation that he would be their bat boy. And I think by facing that challenge in the newsroom, you convinced them you became an anchor. We're going to take a little break again, and then we are going to get Walter from his early days on TV to the legendary pairing of Walter Jacobson and Bill Curtis, because Walter and I could talk for days. I've already booked him for October when the paperback edition of his fine biography, lively, surprisingly self-effacing, Walter's Perspective, a memoir of 50 years in Chicago TV news, comes out in paperback. So don't worry, you're not going to get it all tonight. You'll get more in October and then more later on. We'll be right back with Walter Jacobson. After 10 o'clock, the news at 10 o'clock, we'll be talking about Ella Fitzgerald, a upcoming concert that is next weekend. I've got 10 more minutes with Walter Jacobson today, and then he will be back in October when the paperback edition of his fine biography comes out. More than 50 years in the news business, there is a lot to talk about. We've got him. He's in TV. He's been hired by the legendary John Madigan at WBBM. He has stepped up to fill in for an anchor who didn't show up.
Carter Davidson.
Oh, man, I remember Carter Davidson. Wow. And did that give you a real taste for being on camera? To know that you could do it.
Yeah, real taste, but not a very good one.
Why not?
The anchor role was not very interesting to me because it's more technical than it is thoughtful. And I didn't like reading the prompter, and the prompter went wrong. And if it goes upside down, there's nothing you can do.
Yeah.
In any case, I wasn't given anchorman role. It was just that one time.
Right.
I was a reporter and a political reporter, and I got in trouble with Madigan because I was sticking my face in front of the camera at City Hall and saying, Mayor Daley says this, but what Mayor Daley means is that. And, you know,
well, it was hard. That's a great thing. Covering Richard J. Daley, it was an art to figure out what Richard J. Daley was actually saying after he had said something. Were you at all, what were your first, you know, a kid from the suburbs, he didn't grow up in much in the city, and Daley was very much a city kid,
really,
than a city man. Were you impressed by him, the physical? I mean, I've saw Daley often, and I always thought there was something very imposing about him in person. He wasn't a huge guy, but he was...
But he was very solid.
Yeah.
And he was wide, and you knew who he was, and you knew what he thought, and he was overwhelming in conversations. Not conversations, more lectures.
Sure.
Saying what he wants to say, and not wanting to say what he doesn't want to say, and not letting reporters make him say what he didn't want to say. He was a statuesque, big, ruddy face with a great laugh.
I remember
and you
when
know
he,
what, Rick? Huh. He loved this town. He never was interested in pennies. He wasn't making money like we think other politicians were, or at least none
Tom
of us
Keene
ever able
and
to
some
fight.
Others, yeah.
Yeah. And I was just...
How did he treat, when you first came over there, the press corps, you got guys like Harry Golden in the press corps, you got guys like Jay McMullen, who eventually married Jane Byrne in the press corps. It's a pretty big press corps over there, and all of a sudden you come in as the kid. How were you treated by those guys and the mayor?
I don't think the guys didn't pay much attention to me because I hadn't made a name for myself yet by any means.
Right.
The mayor, I could tell, I knew even then, I was sensitive, that he was irked. he had a feeling that this little kid's going to cause him some trouble down the road.
Yeah, he doesn't know the ropes.
He cut me off when I asked a question he didn't want to answer. But I was so overwhelmed by the power that he had. You know, he was all politics, and not as, I was going to say dumb, but that's not the right word.
No,
he's got the he had the reputation, as did his son Richard M.
Yeah.
Of not being particularly intellectually smart. But they were both a hell of a lot smarter than we thought they were.
Well, I couldn't
don't
agree
get
with
where
you
are without being very clever. Street smart and economics smart, right?
There's no question. When you were over there, Walter, I have to believe that experience kind of fostered the seed of what became your perspectives, because your perspectives were generally, not always, but generally, you know, reporting. Perspectives were reported. They just weren't thoughts off the top of your head. You were doing investigative, short investigative pieces. You must have seen during your time there covering City Hall and being in the county building things that troubled you, things that you thought needed reporting on, right?
Yeah, and I kind of worked myself into a position as a commentator, by no means identified as such. I was a City Hall reporter, but I would add my commentary to a point where CBS got really ticked off at what I was doing and tried to get me, or not tried, did get me to stop.
What did they tell you? We don't want to hear your opinion.
No, they didn't want to say that. They do the Madigan and the others who followed him didn't want to say that they were being bothered by, I believe, City Hall.
Yeah.
And they didn't need that kind of controversy. But I was saying things that got people's attention, and I just kept doing it. As I said to you, I stand out in front of City Hall and said, the mayor says one thing but is meaning and acting in another way. And I was told, in no uncertain terms, Walter, you are a reporter. Who do you think you are, being a commentator? You're not ready to be a commentator. And there's only one commentator in this town, and nobody will ever be.
Who was Len O'Connor?
Len O'Connor, yeah, of course. And Len O'Connor was my idol.
Yeah.
I wanted to do what he did.
Yeah.
So they got to a point where they kind of had to identify me as something other than a reporter, or fire me. They want to fire me because I was beginning to make a name for myself,
sure.
And then they would have had to explain it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So they called me political editor, which gave me a little bit of leeway.
Mm.
And what made this the commentary, the perspective work, was not me any more than the two guys and a girl, woman that I was working with, my assistants, to come up with enough evidence to support the conclusion I made as a commentator. That's where the reporting and the commentary got together.
Boy, it has been, when you look back, and now I'm going to get into this whole being 80 thing and getting very reflective about your career, you have to be kind of amazed at the course it's taken. I mean, even now the tricycle story, for God's sake, the tricycle story, the Bat Boy story, the having to go down to the Naked City, which may have been the name of that nudist colony. If it's not, it would have been a great name for a nudist colony. But confronting those things and this unbelievable passion that you had. The interesting thing about you, Walter Jacobson, is, and I know this, you still have that passion. It has not waned. You may not have the vast outlets you once had, but you still have that passion, don't you?
How can you not? And every year it seems to get better and bigger because of what's going on, both here with Rauner and Rahm and in Washington, my God. But I wanted to be the commentator, and I wrote these things in a commentary way, and I was aware that the station manager and the news director were uncomfortable with it, but I somehow managed to keep doing it, and it was the researchers, my leg men, and the camera crews. My things wouldn't have been of much impact if they didn't have the pictures to go with them.
Sure.
I can't do that anymore.
That's what TV does, right. Man. That's what TV does. Walter, it is really an ongoing pleasure to know you. Walter's on today to sort of celebrate his 80th birthday, because that's worth celebrating, to celebrate his kicking two kinds of cancer and to celebrate the announcement of the public paperback publication of his fine biography, My Perspective, 50 years. I don't remember the real title, but it's 50 years in the TV news. But it's not just TV news, as you heard tonight. It was newspaper news. And it was a tricycle and a dead body on Devon. This has been a real treat, Walter. We'll do it again for an hour in October.
That's great, Chris. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Happy.
I said Chris, right?
Happy birthday. Happy birthday. Well, you're going.
Thanks, Rick. Thank
you're thinking you. The naked story is just priceless, with your little bag with your clothes and your notebook around your hand. That is the one and only voice of Ella Fitzgerald. This is Rick Kogan. You just heard Walter Jacobson go on about the tricycle suicide, the nudist colony in Indiana. He will be back on. It's my great pleasure to have on my old friend, a terrific singer, a producer, and Daryl Nitz. I'm going to call you now an impresario. Do you mind?
I guess by this time I've earned that.
Yeah, you've worked your way into it. On August 10th, 1958, Ella Fitzgerald recorded Ella at Mr. Kelly's, an LP, right, as they called them in those days. It has taken on, Daryl, the status of legendary, has it not?
Yes, exactly. So much that, they've written about this concert. There's recordings. You know, people do a breakdown, like, for example, like In the Wee Small Hours, you know, of the Morning was like a song that was like only recorded twice in her career, and the first time she recorded that, or Cross the Alley from the Alamo. And because this was also the first time that she did a concert in a very small club.
Yeah.
She had done, you know, live concerts with big orchestras. But, you know, they did this with just a trio.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And then when it was her 90th birthday back in 2007, they released like an extended, you know, CD with things that were never on the LP, kind of like what they did with the Judy Carnegie Hall concert.
When did you get, Daryl Nitz, the notion to do as you are doing, a show next Sunday at 7:30 at the Skokie Theater, which is a fine, fine venue? Ella Live at Mr. You're recreating the concert. Ella Live at Mr. Kelly's, a centennial celebration concert for Ella Fitzgerald. When did this idea come to you, and how'd you pull it together?
Okay, so I've been doing concerts like this since 2004. First thing I ever did was a Judy Garland recreation when they kind of remastered this. Since then, I've only done shows that might be 100th birthdays, or I did a John Lennon 75, you know. But now there's actually a lot of people that go out and do those things now.
Sure.
So I'm looking for, I wanted to do an Ella, but there's a lot of Ella centennial celebrations coming up. There's going to be one, I think just like in the next week as well, somewhere else, at City Winery.
Mm-hmm.
And so I want to do something with a Chicago connection. And that's when I remembered, oh, yeah, they released this, Mr. Kelly's, with extra songs, and started looking at it and talked to some of my friends, a particular guy, Scott Urban, that I just said, you know, if you're going to go to a concert, would you rather go see an Ella kind of retrospect, or do you want something like this where I might recreate the Mr. Kelly's? And he was like, oh, I would be more interested in the, you know, Mr. Kelly's. Of course, he knew. And both of us, I mean, he knows very well, Buddy Charles.
Sure.
Who started at Mr. Kelly's, and Audrey Morris. And the two of them were, you know, so kind to me when I was coming up in this business, you know, 25 years ago. Yeah. So,
well, know, I think Daryl, I think, Daryl Nitz, you've really struck on something, because I know you know him, David Marienthal, the son and nephew of the two guys, George and Oscar Marienthal, who ran Mr. Kelly's and the London House and the Happy Medium. This is not some kind of nostalgic thing. That place, talk about legendary, that place has a really solid spot in the hearts of a generation or two of music lovers. I think it's you must have been hearing that since you started to announce this stuff, yes?
Yeah, actually, I have. I didn't, like, for example, there was a musical done by Three Cat Media or something. I didn't know about it when I was doing this, but as I started looking at, you know, someone did a musical and featured more, I guess, the stuff of Barbra Streisand, because that's kind of a legendary.
Oh, no question.
Right, exactly. And, you know, it's interesting because there are a lot of people that got their start there at Mr. Kelly's, but, you know, Billie Holiday, Ella Fitzgerald, they were already established.
Right. Well, you know, Lenny Bruce got his sort of started there. Woody Allen got his start there. It was a pretty amazing place. And it was, you know, this is before, you know, mass market entertainment. And as you well know, and I think the one thing that distinguishes Ella at, you know, she is really one of the all-time great singers of any sort. To see her in the intimacy that was Mr. Kelly's,
right.
And you're going to be able to create that, I think, at the Skokie Theater, because that's a pretty intimate space.
Yeah, it's a little bit bigger. It's 150 seats, but it is. You know, I was doing shows at Davenport's, and that's where I've been singing in the front room. I'm going to be starting 18 years.
Oh my God! Really?
Yeah.
Wow, yeah. Daryl. Wow.
So I started my 18th year here in the end of August, and I was doing shows. I did my Billie Holiday there. I did an Elaine Stritch. I did John Lennon there. But they sell out so quickly, and I needed a bigger space to do them. And so I've been producing now exclusively at the Skokie Theater for about 2 years. Yeah, about 2 years, like 2 or 3 years. No, I guess 2 years exclusively.
Yeah, I think it's a great venue. And one of the nice things that Daryl Nitz is doing for all of you listeners is if you go to the Skokie Theater website, which is so easy, Skokie Theater with an RE.org, and click on the Ella Live at Mr. Kelly's thing, he is, because he doesn't care anything about money, because he's a cabaret singer, so you know, who cares? I didn't make any money. He doesn't care about money. He will give anybody, all you need to do is click the promo code WGN, and you'll get $10 off, which is pretty considerable. It's like 33% off the ticket price.
Yeah.
How many songs? You've gathered, not only are you going to sing, but you've also gathered a number of great singers. Let's talk about some.
Yes. So, for example, and I'm really turning over a lot of this to the women. I will say this about my concerts that I try to that I produce. What I try to do is even the pre-show music sets a tone for the evening. So I did like a recreation of some of the music with the Kennedy inauguration.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, for his centennial. And you'll hear, you know, him speak. Well, same with this. I'm using, like, Dee Dee Bridgewater's Dear Ella in the pre-show music, plus songs that are not featured in this concert. And then I'm even using some of the, you know, sound bites of the announcing and letting Ella Fitzgerald, because it's so short, her rendition of Anything Goes, that will actually close the night. This concert portion, we're all going to do Mac the Knife as kind of a curtain call.
What a great idea. Well, because always, Daryl, I'm not going to say just the cabaret singer, you're a great cabaret singer, but you also have this, you know, you have theatrical wings that you like to spread, and you do it well, man. You do it well.
It's a teacher in me, you know what I'm saying?
That's right.
You know, yeah. But some of the people in the show, Frida Lee, she'll be opening the show, and she's going to be doing Your Red Wagon and Nice Work If You Can Get It. And everybody's doing three songs. She's also doing I'm Glad There's You. Frida's, you know, she's been in Chicago singing for many years.
Oh,
she's
sure.
Even going to be part of the city's Ella Fitzgerald part of Jazz Fest.
Right, right.
I'm using a woman from Milwaukee, Ellen Winters, and she's done Ella Fitzgerald shows. She has an Ella and Mel show that she does with Johnny Rogers, very successful. She's done her own Ella show. Lynn Jordan, who performs at City Winery and used to be at the Drake.
Oh, yeah, I know Lynn well.
Yeah. And then Jeannie Tanner, who's just recently had success with her CD where, you know, it's all her music and, you know, like Paul Marinaro and a bunch of people singing. She's in it. She's doing In the Wee Small Hours and Witchcraft. Witchcraft, by the way, this is like one of the only times that she had recorded, that Ella recorded Witchcraft.
I know.
The first time.
Well, the song, you know, to hear Ella Fitzgerald or one of these fine singers sing, you know, Nice Work If You Can Get It, The Lady Is a Tramp, Summertime Will Bring the House Down. Yeah. There's no, who's singing that?
That's Lynn Jordan. And she called me. She's like, do you want all these lyrics that she's doing? Well, if you can do them, yeah. You know, I try to give people the leeway, you know, because, you know, we aren't Ella, and Ella is, it was a genius. Right. I want people, if they want to take it on and try it, great.
You aren't, and they aren't. It's not like an impersonator show. It's more like it's an homage to you. You stamp Ella's song and style with your own style. And I think that's what makes it so much more exciting than, you know, there are imitator shows out there, but that isn't what's going to make this show what it is. You also got a good band here, too. This is ridiculous.
Oh, yeah. Joe Policastro, I mean, he's got his own trio, and, I mean, he's a great bassist, and, you know, just in the stuff that he does in the jazz scene, and Phil Gratteau. I try to use Phil Gratteau in anything that I do. Yeah. I mean, he works with Judy Roberts all
the
time. I mean,
I know. He's one of the great drummers and also one of the great people I've ever known. You know, that's one of the things, Daryl, in a few minutes we have left. And again, the show is Ella Live at Mr. Kelly's. It's a recreation, a reinterpretation of the concert that Ella Fitzgerald recorded at the legendary Mr. Kelly's on the night of August 10th, 1958. Daryl's show is at the Skokie Theater, which is on Lincoln Avenue in Skokie. Just go to Skokie Theater with an RE.org. It is Sunday, August 6th at 7:30. Tickets are $32, but if you put in the promo code WGN, Daryl Nitz, the financial genius, will give you $10 off the ticket price. That's a very nice thing to do, Daryl. That's a very, very...
Well, I appreciate you having us on.
Oh, man, and this concert...
People listen to your show and always tell me to hear me, you know, on your program.
You know, I've admired you for a long time, and I've loved, you know, Cabaret is my scene. You mentioned the name Buddy Charles, and my heart jumps, and my...
Yeah.
You know, I get sad. Audrey Morris. And Audrey Morris, too. Just two of the greats. This town has a remarkable, remarkable history ongoing. You know, that's one of the cool things. Go ahead.
You mentioned that Chicago was, you said, you know, when talking with Walter about Chicago being, you know, this great news city, which I agree with you, but I also feel that way about music.
Oh.
You know, and I know New York's got its own thing, and, you know, but I feel that we in Chicago, we just have so many people with such great, you know, heart that they give to their audiences. You know, Judy Roberts for as many years as she has performed. And even these people, like I've got like a blues singer in here that, you know, people, you know, putting a blues, Liz Manville, she's a blues.
Yeah,
but Liz can sing anything. You know,
listen, LaShera Moore and Alina Tabor. I mean, this is quite a lineup. You can see the lineup when you go to SkokieTheater.org and find it and get $10 off the ticket. Daryl, I'm a longtime admirer, Daryl Nitz, of everything you do. And one of the other things.
The feeling's mutual.
Well, and the other things you bring to this. That all of these performers do. You don't make a fortune working the cabaret beat in Chicago, but it gives you something. And all of you guys and girls have an incredible passion for this. I've known many of you for decades, and the passion never wanes. So Ella, live at Mr. Kelly's. It is next Sunday at 7:30. Go to Skokie Theater with an RE.org. And you will be able, putting in a promo code WGN, thanks to Daryl Nitz, the impresario and financial advisor, $10 off a $32 ticket is pretty good. Daryl, I hope I can't go because I got the show next Sunday, but I hope it's a great success. Let me know how it goes, will you please?
I will.
All right, Daryl.
And thank you so much.
Always good to talk to you, pal. Right. Knock him dead. Right. Okay, see ya.
Thank you.
See ya.
Bye-bye.
We'll get some commercials in, and then we will talk to many of you. Well, I won't even tell you who we're going to talk to next. But at 10:30, we're going to talk to a very, very, very interesting African-American playwright who is whose plays are spending the entire season in Chicago. We'll be right back on After Hours. That, as you just were hearing, that's the voice of Bill Curtis, who was teamed with Walter Jacobson for many years. We'll get into Bill next time Walter's on, which should be around October. Play ball, celebrate the Cubs with team memorabilia, exclusive books, and so much more. Visit ChicagoTribuneStore.com today. There are many of you, loyal, and thank you listeners to this show, who remember that years ago, a young woman, I think she was a very young woman at the time, named Zita Moore, would occasionally come into the studio, occasionally do it on the phone, and review theater in Chicago. Zita has, I don't know if it's, Zita, how are you? Are you on? Are you?
I'm good.
Are you listening? Do you remember the good old days? Do you remember the good old days when you did those theater reviews?
Oh, way back in 1992 in high school.
Yeah. You were very, very young, but very, very smart. And what I remember, excuse me, about those theater reviews, you were always so kind to the actors and actresses. You mentioned virtually everyone who was in them. I have seen you over the years and then was not just surprised, but thrilled to get your review of a new movie that has gotten roundly good reviews everywhere. And you and your dad, Keith Moore, and your lovely mom, Natalie West, who is an actress, sent it to me. And then you sent it to me. And I immediately said, you got to do this on the air. So you want to do this on the air? This is the return of Zita Moore to the world of audio criticism. Are you ready, Zita?
I think so. This is my review for Dunkirk, directed by Christopher Nolan. Leaflets fall from the sky on the streets of an idyllic village in France. Soldiers fetch them from the ground as the papers collide, their ominous fluttering booming in your ears. We follow a boy clad in the regimental coat of a British soldier. In his eyes, we bear witness to the hardened resolve to survive. He collects the leaflets with his fellow soldiers, scrutinizing them with a benign detachment. When bombs rip through the sky, the boy tears into a sprint. Leaflets go flying in an eerie flurry of white. He finds refuge among a barrier of sandbags, only to shoot from the post the moment another torrent of bombs descends. In the next moment, he clambers past an obstacle and re-enters the place of battle. There, he confronts the staggering sight of his fellow countrymen, awaiting their departure on the shore. Thus begins Dunkirk, Christopher Nolan's magisterial account of a monumental event in World War II. In many ways, the film owes its resonance to Tommy, played by Finn Whitehead, whom we first see comprehending the silent herald of death. He demands your attention with his earnestness to scrape through the onslaught of terror with the skin on his bones and the heart jackhammering in his ribs. Through Tommy, we meet Gibson, played by Aneurin Barnard. Though their journey to a ship carrying the wounded commences in silence, Barnard displays an arresting aptitude for communicating his innermost thoughts without words. Some actors can take your breath away. Give Barnard the chance to steal yours. Viewers will surely recognize Barnard's adversary as well, especially if they know or are the parents of a One Direction fan. Making his film debut alongside Whitehead, Harry Styles proves once and for all that you must not think of him as a pretty face. Well, you can, but I dare you not to marvel over his fierce performance as Alex, a suspicious hothead. Sitting in the Music Box Theater, where I saw the film with a good friend, I was surprised to hear a woman say, Harry Styles? That's stupid. Yeah, it's stupid for anyone to think of him as a vapid heartthrob. His performance is a punch to the gut, and the impact lingers. To say nothing of the soldier played by Cillian Murphy, who pays a tragic price for succumbing to the trauma brought on by his experiences. When a kind gentleman steering a rescue boat, played by theater veteran Mark Rylance, catches sight of Murphy with the help of his son and young friend George, they claim him as their first rescuee. The heartbreaking conclusion of Murphy's story captures the effect of incomprehensible horrors on the mind. The unthinkable events that unfold on the water and the soldiers' desperate attempts to survive are rendered with an astonishing accuracy and agonizing horror. Over at the AV Club, a veteran of Dunkirk assured Global News that he felt just like I was there again. I do not know if Mr. Nolan will have the honor of a more moving compliment to his work. Accolades are due to the tremendous cast who brought the film to life, from the aviators who storm across the skies to the brave rescuers who venture into dangerous waters. Everyone contributed to make the picture a testament to the ravages of war and the hope that shines through the bleakness of the aftermath. The world could use a few miracles right now. Dunkirk is one of them, a film about war that tells the story of a beginning, not an end.
Zita, that is a fine, fine review. I get the sense you really like this movie, huh? Just joking, just joking, just joking. your writing, too, has gotten a lot jackhammering in his ribs. You want to start doing this with some regularity, young lady?
I would love to. And I also want to give a shout-out to John O'Neill, who edited my review and made it the work of art that it is.
Who's John O'Neill? Why don't you let me edit your stuff? What's the matter? Who's this John O'Neill character? Who's he? You don't have to tell me. You don't have to. You can keep it a secret. He's a good editor, if that's what he did. Zita, you're now signed up. There's no pay in it. There's nothing in it. But the next time you see a movie or a play, feel free to send it to me, and we will book you for the show. It is great to have you back in the After Hours. It used to be the Sunday Papers cast, but now you're in the After Hours cast. I'm glad you're still writing, honey, and I'm glad you're still being the observant cat that you are. So, is that a deal?
Thank you.
Is that a deal?
We have a deal.
We have
Thank
a deal.
You.
Give big hugs to your parents and your brother Jack, and I can't wait to get the next one. Just shoot it to me, and it'll be a lovely surprise one morning when I walk in the office, okay?
Well, thank you.
All right, honey. Thanks a million. Thanks a million. That was critic Zita Moore returning to the Sunday Papers fold. That, of course, the voice of Ella Fitzgerald. The fine Eclipse Theater Company has decided to devote this entire season to the works of Kaya Cawthron, a playwright from originally Maryland, then moved to New York, has taken over Chicago. But, Kaya, welcome to the show. Welcome to Chicago, and you're now in where, Minneapolis on the phone?
Yes, and it's Kia.
Are you? You move around. You move around. You have a very, very lengthy history with Chicago theater, don't you, that I was not fully aware of until doing some research. One of your earliest plays, Seeking the Genesis, was performed at the Goodman Theater. So you go way back with Chicago, don't you?
Yeah, that was back in 96, long time ago.
Well, and it got rave reviews. How does this kind of how does this relationship between you and the Eclipse Theater Company, how did this happen?
It sort of came out of the blue. I got an email from the artistic director of the theater, Yeah, I kind of started from there. I didn't know of Eclipse before, and I was really excited when they said they wanted to do an entire season of my plays. And so, I started from there, and then we had discussions about which plays.
Because you have a pretty very substantial body of work. Was there anything a little daunting about the offer? In that, I think as part of the offer, they said, well, we'd also like to do a world premiere, so write a play for us. Do you know what I mean? It's like, well, yes, we'll do two of your old ones, but write a new one because we want to do a world premiere. That can be, I think, that, don't you think? I mean, I'd be a little, I'm not a playwright, but I'd be a little daunted by that. But also nicely flattered and challenged, too, don't you think?
Yeah, well, actually, the play was already written, but it had not been produced yet. It had a couple of readings in New York.
How lucky for you, then. That is the new one. The first one was a show called Force Continuum, which is a play that you wrote. It seems remarkably, and I guess you and the Eclipse Theater Company, knowing what's going on in the city of Chicago these days, the sort of notion of police, the relationship between the police and the public. This, you obviously picked this one because of the unbelievably topical nature of it, the race relations, in essence, race relations and criminal justice system, the confrontation of those two things. So did you immediately... Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, and the relationship between the public and the police. And it was actually originally produced in New York way back in 2001. So, sadly... it's been topical for a long time.
Yeah, no kidding. It was originally based, if I'm not wrong, on a really, really horrific case of police abuse. Correct?
No, it was. Well, there was. It was an amalgamation of many cases. The story is fictional, but very much. After much research of a lot of cases that sadly become rather redundant.
You are also doing, believe me, after a short commercial break, I'm going to get to your novel, which I bought today. I haven't read it. I don't pretend to. In about 5 minutes after we talk a little more about your playwriting, when did you, you're a child of, I don't know Cumberland, Maryland, but I guess it's on the banks of the Potomac. I looked at God love the internet for being able to show me things. And your mom was a homemaker and school volunteer and sometimes a nurse's aide, and your dad worked in a local paper mill. When did you, as a child, get the urge or struck by the lightning that is a writer's life?
Well, when I was in second grade, my teacher encouraged me to be a writer. But actually, even before then, the funny thing with my dad working in a paper mill is that we had all these reams of paper and pens and pencils that he brought home from work.
Oh, come on. Of course. Duh. Yeah.
So my sister is a year older. My mother said that actually it kind of started, especially when she went to school, and I felt lonely for a play might make. But I started doing a lot of writing, making little books and things.
That's great. And when you're in school and you start to think of, and it's tough. I mean, I'm a writer too, and you start to think of a writer's life and a career as a writer. You must at some point understand that maybe you don't. I don't remember if I felt that. Well, I'm not gonna make any money doing this. This is not the most practical career choice in my. I guess when I'm 18 and you were 18, you don't really think that way. But you determined. Was there a time when you were in school, in college, and or post college work where you said, because you did get a master's in theater arts at Columbia, that I want to make this. I want to make the theater my life. Do you remember? Can you recall at all? I know it wasn't a decision. You can? Good, good. I want to hear this. I want to hear this. Go ahead.
I had been encouraged to be a writer. I decided I wanted to be a writer, but I didn't know what my discipline would be. And it wasn't until the very last semester of college that I took a playwriting class. And the final assignment was we all had to make a 15-minute scene from the stuff we've been working on the entire semester. And everybody else, because we were these infant playwrights, we didn't know what 15 minutes was. So everybody else's went on 5 minutes. I, until that point, I've been kind of the star of the class. People really liked my work. but it went on for half an hour. And I heard this woman sighing, so I thought, okay, everybody's bored, but I will, you know, this is my comeuppance for being the star people all the time, so I just thought I would take it. And so then the light came up in the classroom after my scene was finished, and when everybody else's scene would end, people would jump in and say, oh, I like this, this was great, I wish there was more of this. At the end of my scene, there was complete silence. No one said anything, which really startled me. And then I realized the person who I thought was sighing was crying.
Oh,
and
wow.
When people finally said things, including the teachers, it was sort of one-word things like poignant. And I realized all my years of school and writing classes that all of the flattery that I had gotten meant nothing to me as much as having inadvertently rendered this audience to silence. And I was also very aware that it was these actors and this audience in this particular afternoon. It's a singular moment. It cannot be repeated.
Yep.
Every audience is different for every show. So I became very excited by the theater. And
wow, what a revelation.
And so recently when I had an idea for a book, I wanted to say an idea for a story that was much bigger than a play, then that became a book. But until then, I was ready for the theater.
What a remarkable, remarkable revelation that is. Wow. That's like, to me, it's like Newton and the apple, for goodness sake. I want to, before we take a short break, talk a little bit more about Kaya Cawthron's residency at the Eclipse Theater Company. This entire year, three shows of hers. The next one, Megastasis, is opening. It is open now. It opened July 13th.
Yeah.
It's running through August 20th at the Athenaeum Theater. What a great building that is. And we'll talk about that show specifically because that is getting its world premiere. I want to, Kaya, remind you about something that was written about you. She has a history in Chicago. She had this playwright has a history in Chicago. Seeking the Genesis was at the New Goodman Studio Theater. It was a play about the drug Ritalin. But what the great theater critic Richard Christensen wrote, I don't know if you remember this. If he had written this about me, Kaya, I would have it tattooed on my arm. He talks about the play, what makes her drama an occasion of great joy is the presence of a unique and powerful voice in the theater. Not since the emergence of August Wilson has there been a playwright who has created language in such a fever of fervent poetry. He goes on to say, now in her early 30s and a writer holder of several grants and prizes, including a recent grant from the Kennedy Center Fund for New American Plays, this gifted playwright needs to couple her language with a firm narrative form. When she does, it is going to be incredible. You remember that?
Yes, it was a long time ago.
Yes. Wow. Richard was a hero of mine and was a great, great theater critic. That is as good an endorsement as I have ever heard. We'll take a short break and we'll come back and talk about the playwright who has taken over the Eclipse Theater Company at the Athenaeum Theater. You can go to eclipsetheater.com. You can go to, when we talk about Kaya's book, her new and first, and I guess long seeding novel, I'll give you her website when we come back. That's Ella Fitzgerald, and Kaya, is it Kaya or Kia, your first name?
Kia.
That's so interesting because there's a lovely young woman on my daughter's 13-year-old volleyball team who spells it the same way. And I say it Kaya because I scream, Kaya, hit it. You are in residence. So Kia it shall be. Kia Cawthron is sort of in residence at Chicago's Eclipse Theater with three plays. The first was Force Continuum. The second, currently running, is Megatastas, which is having its world premiere. Could you summarize this for the listeners? It seems like you have a very, very, I think from everything I've read of you and about you, you're a very socially conscious playwright. You don't to abbreviate what you do. This is about a 19-year-old kid and who gets in some trouble. Yes.
Yes. The title Megastasis is actually a made-up word that happens in the play, but it's a 19-year-old named Trey who he lives with his grandfather. He has an infant, very caring for his child. But what happens is, at some point, he smokes a joint at the wrong time and sort of gets caught up in the whole criminal justice system.
Yeah.
It was very much inspired by Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow.
Sure.
About how the black community has been decimated by the war on drugs.
Well, sure, like most of your work, it has a political point of view. I will get up to see that. And the third one is, oh, no, I want to say I'm hooked on you now. What the things I've read, you do a little. It's one of the joys of the Internet is you can really get you can get seduced by a writer. Believe me. And just what Richard just by what Richard Christensen said, that was more than enough for me. You also do some free readings and you do events throughout the year. So I will come to one of those, too, to meet you. The final show is the fall show, November 2nd to December 17th, called Breathe Boom. But you can go to Kia's website, now that I can pronounce her name. I'm going to spell it for you. It's KIACORTHRON-author, I'm not going to spell that for you, .com. KIACORTHRON-author.com. Kia, your new and first novel is titled The Castle Cross the Magnet Carter. It is your first novel. It is a long time in coming. It sounds, and I ordered it today from a bookstore, mind you, so I can pick it up tomorrow. It is about two sets of brothers, basically, in different places, one south and one in small-town Maryland, which the confrontation... It's a coming-of-age story, is it not? Though I'm loath to use that term. What is it?
The first part of it is it takes place... it begins in 1941 and goes through 2010... And it's the perspective of four men. I mean, there are lots of women in the book as well, but the four protagonists are two sets of brothers. Two are white, Alabama, and two are black from small town Maryland, much like my town that I grew up. And they're in their youth at the beginning and old age by the end. And one of the white brothers is deaf, and one of the black brothers is gay. The other one becomes a lawyer during the early civil rights movement. And that's actually the climax of the book, and where the two families intersect is during the early civil rights movement.
Yeah, it sounds, on the surface, it sounds, and I'll read it this week and review it next week on the air, it sounds pretty amazing. It does sound, as you said, bigger than a play. Was it difficult to write? I mean, you have written, you've been a very prolific playwright, and the styles, if someone says, hey, you're a writer, you can write anything, I don't adhere to that at all. I think, you know, poetry is different than prose, and playwriting is different than narrative, long fiction. Was it easy for you to change? Did you have to change gears, in a sense?
Well, because I hadn't written fiction since short fiction when I was very young in school. Basically, I was teaching myself how to write a novel with every draft of this novel. And I will say, I feel, for me, there's so many differences, but I felt more similarities.
Uh-huh.
Although I think that's partly because I wrote a novel as a playwright would. I have a friend who's a director. When the novel first came out, not long after that, I ran into him in the theater in New York, and I found out, I didn't know that he was reading my novel. At that point, he said he was 20 pages near the end, and it's a big novel, 800 pages, so
wow.
he was close to the end. He reads aloud, so he'd run the entire book, I think, at his kitchen table aloud, because that's the way he likes to read. But it was interesting because he said it made him think he was aware of me being that it was written by a playwright, not just because of the dialogue, because many people say that playwrights, you know, it's our strength that we can be very
sure.
strong with dialogue.
It better be your strength, also, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Also because of the drama of it. And I actually wasn't really thinking that some novels can be very internal and it doesn't necessarily have to be so dramatic.
Yeah.
But with me, as a dramatist, yes, there's rising action. It's Aristotelian all over the place. So.
Well, you have made my summer already because I will go see... see the play currently at Megathesis at the Eclipse Theater Company at the Athenaeum Theater, the great old Athenaeum Theater, 2936 North Southport.
Go to,
oh, it's fantastic. And you say this having, you know, already done The Good Men and Pegasus and having some history with this fabulous theater town. Eclipse Theater. Yeah, this is a good place for you, I think. This really is, and especially the kind of work you do. Kia Cawthorn, I'm going to give you the website again because it's a cool, nice website, and you can order her book, too, her novel. It's kiacawthron-author.com, and it is eclipsetheater with an re.com. Kia, I look forward to meeting you sometime. I'm a great admirer, and I say this without having read or seen any of your work, which is I'm making an incredible leap of faith just on listening to you talk and reading what little I could find online that you've written. So I look forward to meeting you. Thank you, and I speak for the city of Chicago, and I hope you're having a grand time here, and welcome, and come back from Minnesota and
thank
see
you,
us.
Rick.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Interesting.
Okay.
Interesting woman. Walter Jacobson, this is a full show, so I guess I really am back. I need to thank, as always, Aubrey Mumfauer, who shares the birthday. I'll never forget this. For the rest of my life. I don't know what that means, but God help me. Aubrey Mumfauer and Walter Jacobson share the same June 28th birthday, July 28th birthday. So next July 28th, I would like to see a lot of presents sent to Aubrey Mumfauer, care of WGN Radio. I will not give you Walter's home address. And filling in for Lise Graham, Camille Suknovich has been a delight. Just a great producer. I hope you find a real home where they pay you some money to be a great producer. You, especially all, for listening. Thanks a million. See you next week when Roger Badish will be one of the guests.